Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. A Sudanese delegation meets with rebel parties once again in Juba.
This meeting of today is about the evaluation of the agreement which was signed during the Sudanese Revolution in Front when they were one group.
And the Prime Minister of Sudan calls on Sudan's friends to help the country.
The world and our region is desperately looking for a success story. The ingredients of it are there. If we work together in making this Sudan experiment a success story, we can all be proud of it.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar met briefly today with President Salva Kiir in Juba. We are told the two leaders did not discuss the contentious issue of the number of states or their boundaries. Yesterday, we told you that SPLM-IO deputy spokesman said the two will try to break the deadlock over that issue. The deputy spokesman for the SPLM-IO, Manamwa Peter, said unless the parties resolve the dispute over the number of states and their boundaries, the SPLM-IO would not take part in a transitional government. Our reporter at the scene of those talks, Dimo Silva Aurelio, says at today's meeting, Machar requested permission to meet with civil society activists while he is in Juba. The third round of Sudanese peace talks between the Sudanese government's delegation and several rebel groups that operate in Darfur, the Blue Nile area, and southern Kordofan got underway today in Juba. South Sudanese government mediators say the talks are aimed at ending years of conflict and to reach agreements on security and political issues. For VOA News, Waki Simon Rudu has this report from Juba.
South Sudanese mediators say various rebel groups in war-torn regions of Darfur, Blue Nile, and southern Kordofan are expected to strike a long-awaited peace deal with the Sudanese government during the 2 weeks of talks. Mediators began the day by evaluating the implementation of a ceasefire signed in August and October during the first and second round of talks, according to South Sudan government official and mediator Diu Mathok.
This meeting of today is about the evaluation of the agreement which was signed during the Sudanese Revolution in Front when they were one group. But subsequently, tomorrow we are going to discuss based on tracks, and the groups are going to table their framework agreement tomorrow.
The heads of the various rebel coalitions have expressed optimism on ending hostilities with Khartoum during this round of talks. Abdel Aziz Al-Hilo is head of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Army North, or SPLMA North, a coalition of three opposition parties at the talks.
We are optimistic that this coming round will achieve positive results towards a logical end to the peace process. The government delegation was understanding and cooperating in the second round of talks, in spite of the complicated nature of the conflict.
Ali Hilo says the rebel groups believe the issue of national identity and a failure to define the relationship between religion and state are the root causes of Sudan's internal political problems.
The only solution is to admit the chronic problems and eradicate them to save the country. We have to confront the root causes of the conflict and lay a strong foundation for national unity, correct nation building formula. This is what lacking in Sudan since independence.
Mathok says he expects the Sudanese government and the rebel groups to strike a deal on political and security issues. He did not elaborate on those issues. He also says the parties are discussing humanitarian access and power sharing. Al-Hadi Idris is the head of Sudan Revolutionary Front, or SRF, a coalition of nine rebel groups involved in the talks.
SRF recognizes that our country is undergoing through critical transitional period, and that requires from all of us come into political consensus and to accelerate the peace process so that we can achieve a durable, comprehensive peace, but in shortest possible time. The peace that we're going to achieve will lay a solid foundation for the stability of transitional institutions and the success of political and democratic transformation in our country.
Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, Deputy President of the Sudan Transitional Military Council, who is leading the government delegation, arrived in Juba from Khartoum yesterday. Dagalo says his team has a full mandate to negotiate a peace settlement with all of the rebel groups. Speaking in Arabic, he says the government wants to end the suffering of the Sudanese people, especially the suffering of the internally displaced and refugees who have fled the country.
The peace in Sudan is becoming real and living within the people of Sudan. What is happening today here, we have come to make sure that we achieve peace that is felt by all people, and that will solve issues of justice and equality.
The talks mediated by the South Sudan government and backed by the African Union and regional bloc IGAD are aimed at ending years of conflict between Khartoum and the rebel groups operating in Darfur, the Blue Nile region, southern Kordofan, and eastern Sudan. The rebels say the people living in those areas have been marginalized, oppressed, and discriminated by the previous regime of ousted President Omar el-Bashir. Several rounds of talks mediated by the African Union in recent years had failed to resolve the problems between the rebel fighters and the government. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok has called on friends of Sudan to help the country achieve lasting peace and economic growth. At a conference in Khartoum today, Hamdok said Sudan is ready now more than ever before to cooperate with its friends to overcome the country's many challenges. Michael Atit has the details on that story for VOA from Khartoum.
In his opening remarks at the Friends of Sudan conference, Prime Minister Hamdok appealed to Friends of Sudan to intervene economically to enable Sudan regain its image. He says Sudan still faces many challenges that need intervention from partners to help revive the economy and institute many reforms.
There are so many other priorities, including addressing the economic crisis and reviving our national economy. We started the process of restructuring state institutions, building solid foundations for establishment of the rule of law, transparency, accountability, justice, and transitional justice for that matter, which is firmly linked to the peace process, issues of combating corruption and addressing the issues of recovery of stolen assets are all in our priority.
Hamdok says any transitional government is always faced with several challenges, but Sudanese officials are determined to lead by example. He says what they need now is a helping hand.
In the midst of this region, which is riddled with crises and problems, came Sudan with this hope. And I think the world and our region is desperately looking for a success story. The ingredients of it are there. If we work together in making this Sudan experiment a success story, we can all be proud of it. The stars are aligned to uplift the entire region, and the multiplier effect on this is so huge.
Hamdok says the three-month-old government in Sudan has achieved a lot, but the needs of the Sudanese people are large and require a commitment from friends to help elevating the suffering of the people.
Establish the two structures out of the three, the Sovereign Council and the Ministerial Council. We are yet to put in place the legislative, but we didn't wait for that. We're almost like thinking on our feet. We're saying, implementing this, every success leads to another.
Hamdok says the transitional government in Sudan expects partners to help provide humanitarian assistance to the conflict-affected areas such as Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile regions. He says the government and all other armed groups currently engaged in peace talks in Juba have expressed their commitment to achieve lasting peace in the country. Hamdok says the country is now much more open to foreign investment than ever before. Last week, Hamdok visited the United States, where he discussed with Trump administration officials the possibility of removing Sudan from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism. He says the U.S. promised to take positive steps on that matter. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Meanwhile, some Sudanese residing in Juba have welcomed Sudan's recent move to overturn the controversial Public Order Act, which they say discriminated against women. They say they hope Sudan's Sovereign Council will restore peace and security in all of the country's states, as we hear from Viola Elias in Juba.
A week ago, the transitional government in Sudan abolished the controversial 1996 Public Order Act, which outlawed certain clothing for women, women working in public places, and selling alcohol. Section 18 of the Act states that any person who exercises peddling on the crossroads and side street or exhibit goods, services in the market shall be punished with 50 lashes or imprisonment up to 1 year and confiscation of goods display. Nejo Abdullahi, a Sudanese who lives in Juba, says abolishing the act is one of the main achievements of the transitional government. She says many Sudanese women suffer in silence. Abdullahi says she was a victim of the Public Order Act in 2010 when Sudanese security personnel accused her of selling local brewed alcohol, an accusation police could not verify.
The Public Order Act should be abolished completely. Because in the past we experienced many things with the Public Order Act when we were still in Sudan. Even for me, I was once beaten by the Public Order Police to the extent I sustained injuries on my body.
Sarah Hussein, another Sudanese resident in Juba, says she expects the historic change in Sudan leadership to lead to positive change. Speaking in Arabic, Hussein says the transitional government, headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, should consider compensating families that lost their loved ones during the revolution which led to the ouster of former President Omar al-Bashir. She says peace and security in the areas of Darfur, southern Kordofan, and Blue Nile should be a top priority of the government.
To provide security and stability, we need to see people living in stability and to ensure we are happy with the new Sudan. We wish for best, for people to live in happiness and working in a secure environment. We need to see young children and their parents living in happiness.
Nadia Muhammad, another Sudanese citizen living in Juba, says she expects to see many women occupying government institutions. Speaking in Arabic, Muhammad says there are many qualified Sudanese women who can serve their country if given a chance.
We have women who are graduates with their certificates, but they are staying at their homes without employment or jobs because of the old regime. But now with the new regime, things are moving well.
Amir Hassan Ibrahim, another Sudanese living in Juba, says previous governments in Sudan used to appoint only ruling party loyalists to government jobs. Speaking in Arabic, Ibrahim says all previous governments led by Al-Azhari, Aboud, Nimeri, and Bashir appointed only certain women who were loyal to the ruling party to government positions and neglected women from other political parties.
But now it is the people of Sudan who are selecting the people they want to see being appointed to government positions. The Sudanese people are the government at the moment. Even the Minister of Foreign Affairs is a woman, and we wish her well. We hope in future there shall be a lot of opportunities for more women to be appointed.
Ibrahim says she hopes there will be many more opportunities for women in Sudan. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. An apology to South Sudan's government from an NGO. Find out what that apology is all about when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help someone dealing with depression?
I just give my time to that person and we discuss matter concerning that depression which that person is facing. First of all, I'll find out what is depressing that person. And when I find out the root cause, of course, I try to advise the person according to what he or she is going through.
By counseling the person through counseling and then sharing ideas. Maybe sometimes going out for football or watching football, movies, such things can also help.
I recommend music, the music therapy. Music therapy in the sense that music has a way of giving a soothing feeling whenever the person listens to music.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1-202-630-8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1-202-630-8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The regional head of the Bangladeshi NGO BRAC today apologized to the South Sudan government for a security alert that her organization issued to its staff in November, saying the alert was an improper internal security advisory issued without permission by one of her staff members. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
In November, a letter entitled UN-issued security alert in South Sudan went viral online. The letter was reportedly shared by a monitoring, evaluation, accountability and learning officer for BRAC South Sudan, which identified 8 locations in Juba where UN protection forces may be stationed in case of a crisis. It advised all UN and NGO staff to move with their IDs while on duty and to stock enough water and food to last for at least 10 days as November 12th, the day on which a transitional government was to be formed, was fast approaching, and the letter indicated concern that the country might undergo political tensions. The parties later agreed to extend the transitional period by 100 days. On November 5th, the Foreign Affairs Ministry issued a press statement telling the UN and NGOs to refrain from involving themselves in South Sudan's internal affairs and desist from issuing what the government called unacceptable and baseless allegations which, quote, are only meant to create panic, end quote. Deng Dao Deng, Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs, says the government contacted David Shearer, Special Representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan, regarding the matter, but he disassociated the UN from the allegations. An investigation carried out by the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission traced the security alert to BRAC. Ruth Okowa, BRAC's Director for Africa Region, apologized to the government by reading a statement today.
BRAC would like to issue a sincere apology to the people of the Republic of South Sudan for the unprofessional conduct of some of our staff in the way they handled security-sensitive information. On Friday, November 1st, 2019, an authorized and an improper internal safety advisory was circulated to all staff of BRAC South Sudan. The communication was only meant for internal audits.
Okowa admitted that sharing incorrect and sensitive information in a public forum can negatively affect safety and cause alarm. She says she regrets the communication by BRAC staff was circulated without permission from a manager.
The internal email was drafted and circulated by a member of the security team without consulting anyone from the senior leadership of BRAC South Sudan, the region office where I sit, and our aid office. So it was a personal communication without the blessing of the organization. And I really want to underscore that the communication had nothing to do with BRAC as an organization.
Okowa says BRAC has taken serious actions against the concerned staff. Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Deng says South Sudan is concerned about BRAC's action in South Sudan because it caused panic.
This alert has created havoc throughout the country. It prevented many people from carrying on their normal activities for innocence. The great number of people were running to seek safety where necessary, while others were unable to go to church services, schools, hospitals, work and marketplace, etc.
Deng says it is only the government and its specialized security institutions that can issue security alerts. Deng says the government has advised BRAC's management to withdraw Wilfred Chibuota, the NGO's country representative for South Sudan, because he failed to control what he calls the damage caused by the alert. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serena in Juba.
Sudan's prime minister says Sudan now has 5,000 troops in Yemen. That's down from a peak of 15,000. Sudan has been involved in Yemen's civil war as part of the Saudi-led coalition that has been fighting Houthi rebels since 2015. Naba Mohadeen has the story for VOA from Khartoum.
On Monday, Prime Minister Hamdok said Sudan has reduced its troop strength in Yemen by two-thirds to just 5,000 troops, and he said no military solution can solve Yemen's crisis. Political analyst Khalid Al-Faki said Sudan leaders see little need for further involvement in the war. He says the internal developments Yemen is seeing requires the fast withdrawal and decrease of Sudanese troops in Yemen. It's also compatible with Hamdok's government approach of not participating in any regional or international wars. The conflict in Yemen erupted in 2014 when Houthi rebels took control of the capital, Sana'a. 1 year later, then-Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir sent troops to support a Saudi-led effort to restore Yemen's legitimate government. 5 years of war have left tens of thousands of people dead and hundreds of thousands more displaced from their homes. The Saudis and Houthis have been holding informal peace talks, although fighting continues. Former Sudanese Army Lieutenant Abdurrahman Mohammed says Sudan is following the Arab coalition's lead. He notes that in July, the United Arab Emirates also reduced its troops' presence in Yemen and withdrew heavy weapons. Muhammad says when those troops went to Yemen, it went under Arab coalition request. Sudan agreed to help the coalition at that time. And now, after a while, the coalition saw that making an agreement with Houthis, it is stated that the two sides should reach an agreement instead of the war. The decrease shows the seriousness of the coalition and Sudan to solve the problem. Sudan's new transitional government, formed in August, is attempting to end all of Sudan's wars, both internal and international, as the country tries to move on from Bashir's 30-year rule. The United States has agreed to restore full diplomatic relations with Sudan after more than two decades, but is still listing Sudan as a state sponsor of terrorism. Naba Mohadeen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Last week, the governor of Kenya's capital, Nairobi, was charged with economic crimes involving millions of dollars. The arrest appears to be in line with President Uhuru Kenyatta's pledge to stamp out corruption. But as Rael Ambour reports from Nairobi, analysts are skeptical that the governor will be convicted.
The governor of Nairobi County, Gideon Mvuvi, was released on bail Wednesday, 5 days after he was arrested on corruption charges. Kenya's public prosecutor said Mvuvi and a group of associates gained $3.5 million through illegal procurement and payment schemes. This is not the first arrest of a high-profile government official on corruption charges since Kenyatta assumed power in 2013. Mvuvi's predecessor, Evans Kidero, was arrested in April. Other top officials arrested in recent years include the chairman of the National Land Commission, the managing director of the Kenya Railway Corporation, and the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Public Service. However, political analyst Herman Manyora says not many believe Governor Mvuvi's arrest will be a turning point. He notes that none of those previously arrested have gone to jail.
I think it is difficult to believe they are serious. Seeing as it were, there are no convictions. At least even the time it takes, even just to conclude a case, you know, cases that Goldenberg issues and what have you, and leasing, they may not have gone to court, but the investigations, those which have gone to court 5, 6, 4 years, really, that is not indicative of a person who is serious about fighting corruption.
Nicholas Kimanzi is a human rights defender who has taken corruption cases to court that involve politicians infringing on the rights of the poor. He says politicians accused of corruption know how to work the justice system to evade prosecution.
When you get the suspect to court, they either apply for anticipatory bail or something happens and now they have a right to bail. And at the end of the day, nobody follows up. Once these suspects are out on bail, first of all, they go and interfere with the witnesses and the evidence. So after some time, you will hear the office of the DPP saying that we did not find sufficient evidence to charge these people, so they've been set free.
President Kenyatta has said that he will not relent in the fight against corruption until the country is swept clean of corruption. Kimanzi says rooting out corruption will take systematic reforms, not just high-profile arrests.
We may need to enact more punitive laws. So we may need to change the way we approach corruption cases so that if you're found to have stolen from a public coffers, then you need, first of all, to resign. You need to leave office. And then it needs to be a capital offense, such that even the terms of bail needs to be so strict so that you can use this as a deterrent.
Last year, President Kenyatta ordered a lifestyle audit of all public servants. The survey found that at least one-third of government workers were unable to account for their declared wealth. Rael Ombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
Rwanda and Qatar have signed 3 agreements setting up a joint venture to build, own, and operate the new international airport in the Bugesera district of eastern Rwanda. Rwanda will hold a 40% stake in the project. Qatar will have 60%. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
The 3 deals are a shareholders agreement, a share purchase agreement, and a guarantee for indemnity. Clever Gatete, Ghana's Minister of Infrastructure, says the Qatar Airways' expertise is needed to build the first-class airport on international standards.
At this time, we are bringing it now to another level. In other words, the first phase will be able to be sufficient to cater for 7 million passengers. And the second phase will be 14 million passengers.
The Bugesera International Airport has been under construction since 2017. The Portuguese construction company Mota Engil has been building it and had held 75% of the project. But the Rwandan government bought up all those shares to transfer a 60 stake to Qatar Airways. The new airport, once completed, will have a passenger terminal covering 30,000 square meters with 22 check-in counters, 10 gates, 6 passenger boarding bridges, among others. Infrastructure Minister Gatete says more airlines will be able to operate in Rwanda because of the size of the new airport.
Even all the other airlines, which have not been coming because of the nature of our airport, will be coming to Rwanda because we'll be having a first-class this time airport, and then interlinking with all the continents will be much easier.
Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Ahmad Al Thani joined Rwandan President Paul Kagame to witness the signing ceremony for the airport project. The Rwandan government says the full project will be done by 2032 at a total cost of $1.3 billion. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
That is our show for this Wednesday. We'll leave you with the song Dudu by Sultan Clinton. We've been listening to Sultan Clinton with his song, Dudu. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Thanks for being here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Do you
I'm gonna go,